good morning. As we approach the end of the year, what's ahead for jobs in 2017? We'll get some perspectives from Tracy Weiland. She's been a technology executive and now tracks career trends for the 21st century. And the Institute for Human Services could use a little help. The point in time count of Hawaii's homeless is coming early next year, and you can get involved. Kima Carvalho of IHS will be here to tell us how. I'm Bill Dorman, in for Beth Ann Konseltich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Improv classes build skills in communication, teamwork, and quick thinking. Skills that extend far beyond the stage. Improv artist Mr. Aaron of Think Fast Improv tells us how it's done. And the Kwanzaa holiday is now 50 years old as a celebration of African American heritage. Sandra Shawhan of the African American on Maui Association gives us the background.
Friday, December 23rd, conversation gets underway right after the news. Just a couple of days out from Christmas. Chris Vandercook, happy Aloha Friday.
Good morning, Bill.
And that also means it's a little more than a week to New Year's, a time when we tend to look back and look ahead in various parts of our lives. That includes work, and it's always helpful to get some perspective from folks who spend time looking at that big picture and discussing trends. Tracy Weiland is one of those people. She's held senior leadership positions at Apple, HP, and Cisco Systems. She's also written nearly a dozen books. A favorite theme is the intersection of technology and jobs. Her most recent work is Employed for Life, 21st Century Career Trends. She joins us this morning from New York. Tracy, thanks for joining us. And what is one important idea for job seekers, you would say, to keep in mind for 2017?
I think one important thing for job seekers to think about is that any piece of our jobs can be automated by software and hardware. In the same way you see a bank teller, you know, the ATM, and we still have bank tellers, they do different things. I think it's important to keep in mind that you have to keep on top of the technology and keep advancing your skills.
You know, your background being in technology and that world changes so fast. What is the best way for someone to position herself or himself for a career, understanding that that is going to change in ways we can't really anticipate?
What I recommend that people do is in their own jobs today is look at the two key technologies in their industry that they could learn. So, for example, if you're in manufacturing, 3D printing and robotics. If you're in the media, for example, it might be social media. So look at what technologies are in your world and try to get trained and learn them so that you can advance yourself and get on top of the curve.
And what's the best way to go about that learning process?
The learning process, so if you're in a job, I would definitely recommend that you ask your manager what kinds of internal training is available to you that you can take. Number two is I reach out to vendors. Vendors are always willing, technology vendors, to train people, teach people. Of course, they have a bias for their own technology, but I would encourage you to meet the vendors. Number three is if you're working in a company, you have a help desk, they can become your best friends as well as the engineers in your firm. And I would also encourage people to join cross-functional teams that need involvement from functional areas on technology projects. So, for example, if your company is developing a new website, offer to be, you know, a user to give input and at the same time learn about the technology. And you can always go to Microsoft stores or Apple stores. They constantly have seminars and programs, many that are free to the public, so that you can just keep on top of technology, learn, you know, as I say, get your hands dirty with it.
You know, you mentioned cross-functional teams, and it seems that the approach of teams and the value of teams is something that also is shifting as we're into the 21st century.
Yes, we used to value the individual contributor. In fact, companies used to bonus the individual who could save the day, so to speak. Today, companies are realizing that the world is just too complex and that you really need a strong team of people. And they really value A players who can actually help B players become, you know, cross the line with them as an A player in a high-functioning team. So it's always a good idea to join teams and get exposure that way. And also think about lateral moves and horizontal moves inside the firm so that you can get more skills in different areas and stay relevant.
You know, staying relevant, one concept you write about is the geezer economy. You highlight one fascinating statistic about my fellow baby boomers. 10,000 baby boomers will turn 65 every day for the next 20 years. And here in Hawaii, already 16.5% of our population is over the age of 65. What are the opportunities in that world that you see?
Well, if you think about it, by 2030, 20% of the U.S. will be over the age of 65. That's a very large market segment. And when you have a market segment, they have needs for different kinds of products and services. And as they drive that need in volume, that creates jobs. I think what most people think about is healthcare. You know, as we get older, we have more visits to the doctor. Our parts wear out, you know, our eyes, our ears, our, you know, our knees and our hips, and they need to be replaced or repaired or upgraded. All of this creates jobs, and in fact, there is a lot of demand for occupational therapists or physical therapists, nurses and doctors, home health aides. You know, if you think about it, we have to make choices as we're older. Are we going to go to a retirement community, or will we prefer to stay home? And what adjustments do we need to do in order to do that safely and in a healthy way? And so home health care is large, and you can see a lot of franchises already developing around that. So if you just look at the impact of the segment, there you could see where the jobs are getting created.
Of particular interest here in Hawaii, you mentioned that travel and leisure is likely a continuing growth area, and part of that also tied to the aging boomers. What does that mean in terms of jobs and careers? And again, thinking beyond, I guess, just the straight service economy, working at a hotel type of job.
Oh, sure. So if you think about it, our baby boomers, according to AARP, are spending about $120 billion now in travel. So that impacts the cruise liners, it impacts the hotels, it impacts the restaurants. But then you also need people to help them plan. You might need different types of tour guides. It could be a ripple effect in not only hospitality, tourism, but also in the local communities who will be netting dollars from people coming to Hawaii, for example. So I think you can see how you have a multiplier effect when dollars are being spent by a segment in different industries.
You know, in Hawaii, we have a baseline of research and work in a lot of forward-looking areas, speaking of technology, renewable energy, oceanography, agriculture with multiple growing seasons, sort of the list goes on. But we don't draw a lot of investment capital from major companies on a consistent basis. In your view, what would it take to make Hawaii a more attractive destination for that corporate investment capital?
Well, you're talking to someone who lives in a technology world, and we look at Hawaii as the place we want to go not to work. I would be hard pressed to say, oh, let's bring all the manufacturing and different kinds of technologies to Hawaii because then my vacation will go away.
But in a knowledge economy where you can work anywhere, why not work in Hawaii, right?
Exactly. So, you know, one, I think companies have to warm up to the idea of telecommuting, remote employees, and many are in Silicon Valley. But as I travel around the United States and around the world, I still see a resistance there. That people want to see people in FaceTime. They want to see them in the same time zone. They want to see them in an office place. So I think and technology is really here to really enable people to live anywhere they want because they can be connected through the telepresence or the Skype or the instant messaging and chat. So to me, I think it's more of the companies really saying, I want to embrace the community. Number two is having the people there who have the right skill sets for what companies are looking for. People know that you go to Silicon Valley for certain kinds of skill sets. So it depends on, is the skill set match what the company is looking for and how can they connect them?
And connect right here in Hawaii. Tracy, thanks very much. Tracy Weiland. writes and speaks about the impact of technology on society, work, and careers. She's written 11 books, including her latest, Employed for Life, 21st Century Career Trends.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It is 8:15, and coming up in the show, the art of improv and how it can be taught. But first, your quiz.
And a little history this morning. Back in 1946, the tsunami that hit Kauai left many wrecked fishing boats. Local resident Walter J. Smith decided to salvage the vessels, fill them with visitors, and run them up the Wailua River, Hawaii's only navigable river. A little over 2 miles long, offers an entree into what was once a royal retreat for Kauai's high-ranking ali'i. Now, Walter wanted to enhance the river's allure, so he invited local musicians, hula dancers, to come aboard the boats and share songs that were gentle in mood. Today, the Smith's Riverboat Tour remains a classic visitor attraction. Still in the hands of the Smith family, by the way. Passengers treated to a single stop at the iconic Fern Grotto, where Smith's entertainers always sing one particular song meant to evoke that special mood. For today's backyard quiz, we want you to name that tune. You can name it in English or Hawaiian. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets a prize.
Mele Kalikimako and happy holidays. I am Tatiana Ramirez. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
We think of improvisation as one of the special skills of jazz musicians, actors, and comedians, but don't most of us spend much of our lives improvising? The self-confidence and quick thinking it requires are skills that can be applied to just about any field of endeavor, and the drop-in classes taught by the local troupe Think Fast Improv reach out to people who aren't necessarily looking for a performing career. Mr. Aaron is an improv veteran who teaches the classes, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning. How are you today?
All right. Life is kind of an improvisation, right? I mean, who has a plan, really?
Yeah, it's kind of... I mean, it'd be nice to be able to script out what you're going to say to everyone in the morning.
Well, it'd be, yeah, especially if you could write in happy endings, right?
Yeah, that'd be great. Doesn't happen. That'd be...
So what's the alternative?
Learn. experience with, you know, talking to people helps. Sometimes, you know, it helps a little if you're not super confident to, yeah, take an improv class or take something that gets you out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Not super far out, but something that's fun and enjoyable and lighthearted, just so you know it's not as scary as it seems.
Were you always an extroverted performer by nature, or did you change when you became an improv guy?
Oh, I was very quiet
really?
Before improv. Uh-huh. I was... When doing certain things, I was confident and I could be loud about it, but interaction with people, I was very standoffish.
Uh-huh.
And very quiet. And improv fixed that.
Well, you would think that something like that would be part of a fundamental nature that would be pretty hard to change.
Yes and no. It's something once you're aware of it, you know, when someone's like, hey, you know, you're really standoffish at parties, if you want to meet people and talk to other humans, you should probably change that.
Yeah.
Then you're aware that you're being that. You know, you're aware that that's something that you do, and you can, you know, practice doing something else, and then that becomes the nature of it.
So you can almost kind of impose a persona on yourself, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, pretty much everything is a role. You know, you go to work, you're playing. You're not the person at work that you are at home. You have a role to do this at work. So if you're in sales or customer service, you're really nice to people while you're being paid to be really nice to people. You're not the same kind of nice to everyone else.
Yeah.
You're probably more genuine nice outside of work.
You're professionally nice.
Yeah, exactly. You're professionally nice at work, but when work's done, you know, a lot of people that are in those fields, they just, I want to not talk to people anymore, or I want to just, you know, I'm done with people for the day.
Yeah, after I'm done with the show, I got nothing to say for the rest of the day. No, just kidding. But you know what I'm saying? It's like one of the things that you learn from work is to do things you have to do, whether or not you feel like it.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a good way of being, you know, learning to be something different. Like it, I don't know, it's really weird to describe. You grow into something new.
Yeah.
So like you know, a lot of people that take the class, it's a well, I'll try it out, and then. Some people like it. Some people are like, well, you know, it's not my thing, but I had a lot of fun. And that's, you know, that we want people to have fun in the class because that's how you learn the best.
Yeah.
You know, you get something reinforced by a happy feeling and a good time, and it sticks with you. Whether you come back, you know, 3 weeks later or not, it's there. You know, like you, it's a fun thing to do. And we have people that, you know, come to one class and then they have to work or they're out of town for like 3 weeks and they come back the next month and it's a new topic and, you know, they jump back in. And so we've had people that have been in the classes for months because they can only take one or two a week and it's just something, or one or two a month, and it's something fun they can do when they have the time. And it's not a, you know, it's not a locked in, like you're here for 8 to 10 weeks, you're paying, you know, X amount of dollars, you know. It's very easy to jump in, and if you can't make it, then you can't make it, and you come back when you can.
But, you know, I'm sure you've heard the familiar line that public speaking is you know, at the very top of people's fear list, right behind, you know, cancer and death. I mean, it's ridiculous how frightened of public speaking people are. So how does that translate into having fun at your first improv class? People must be petrified, I would think.
There's some, I mean, it does happen where, you know, that's why one of our things is, you know, one of the five things you have to, that are in class. One of them is, you know, have fun. The other is you have to go up. Like
you've got to get on stage.
Yeah, there's no, you know, you can't experience it without experiencing it. You can't just spectate and be like, yes, I learned a lot. Well, yeah, but the idea is to get up there and do it. So you know, everyone's up there having fun and looking silly.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no fear of being, you know, looking silly in front of other people.
Because part of it is the fear of being singled out.
Yeah, and if, you know, if everyone is, you know, speaking in consecutive letters of the alphabet for their sentence, it's funny to watch and it's funny to do and it's a challenge and it's something new. And it, you know, it gets you out of that box that your brain is trapped in.
So you say something that starts with A, I say something that starts with B, and off we go.
C, and you just go all the way around the alphabet. One of the funniest ones I ever saw was a group of improvisers from out of town did that at a restaurant and almost pulled it off with the waitress. Like, he didn't, or the waiter, he didn't notice until they got to, like, the queue.
Wow.
And it was, hey, something weird is going, oh, I see what you guys are doing. Yeah,
once you get it around Q, that would be, get pretty challenging.
Yeah,
but that's part of it all is being alert and having a task, right? So that focuses you.
Yeah, and it's about not, you have to not over-focus on it. So you need to know where you are in the alphabet, and if you forget, it's funny, and your partner will help you out by just repeating the word over and over again that they said. Seriously. Oh, I'm on T now. So, you know, it's super fun to do.
But that's also a big part of it, Aaron, is, as you say, what your partner does, the mutual support.
Yeah, it's all about teamwork and trusting that the person on stage has your back. That's why before, like, every show we have, you know, even when we have the community shows where performers come from all over the island, when everyone's going in, everyone is, everyone taps everyone on the back and says, I got your back. So you know there's support. Even if the people off stage are still supporting you, you know. And that's a big thing in improv, is knowing that there are people there to back you up. If you're having trouble, they're going to get you out. So you're not going to be feeling bad about it. You're
Got to eliminate that anxiety. Or
yeah.
It sounds like that works pretty
well. Yeah, I'm not going to do it right. Well, they'll get you out if you're having trouble. They're not going to make you look bad because they want you to have fun. Because when you have fun, everybody has fun in the audience.
Well, Aaron, I'm going to get you out of this interview, buddy. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Mr. Aaron, comedian, is an instructor for Tuesday and Thursday evening drop-in classes in improv offered by Think Fast Improv at the Hi-Fi Co-op in Honolulu's Ward Warehouse. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Throughout the year, you turn to Hawaii Public Radio for news, information, and ideas. We're here for you, and we count on you to be there for us. We gratefully acknowledge William Cottle of Kailua Kona, Akasha Shonenwitz of IAEA, and Travis Flazier of Honolulu for their generous station support. If you can help us out before the end of the year, please consider a tax-deductible contribution to Hawaii Public Radio. You can call 955-8821 during business hours or check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org and the click donate button.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew's Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
The case involving Honolulu's police chief continues to develop, and as an investigation continues, there's new information this morning about a possible complication involving the acting police chief. Civil Beat's Chad Blair joins us with details on that. Chad, what's the latest on that?
Well, Kerry Okimoto, the acting chief, because as you know, Louis K. Aloha is on paid leave for a month. There are suggestions that he's closely tied to some of the allegations involved with that theft of the mailbox that started this whole thing. He has close ties to K. Aloha himself, has been promoted under his leadership. Interestingly enough, Okimoto oversaw a special unit of elite cops that actually investigated and arrested Gerard Puana. That's the uncle of Catherine K. Aloha, who believed was framed for stealing this mailbox. Now, there's no evidence that Okimoto has any wrongdoing involved here. There's no target letter that has been sent to him so far. But Alexander Silvert, the attorney for Puana, is raising questions and saying the police commission should be worried about this, that the acting chief may have direct ties to K. Aloha and what happened with that mailbox.
Chad, is there any indication? We know that the police commission meets early next year.
Right.
But in terms of what they look at, really, because what you're talking about is sort of something that reflects the culture of leadership at the police department, really. Is that something that they're likely to look into?
I think that is a concern. There were other police officers involved as well, two sergeants that were promoted under K. Aloha, and, you know, did they help put an innocent man in jail? This is something that Max Sword and the other police commissioners must take seriously. This is what Alexander Silvert is saying. reputation of HPD is on the line. Our Nick Ruby did talk to at least one of the commissioners, Loretta Sheehan, and she says she shares some of these concerns. You don't want to have suspicion centered around the guy who's in charge of leading the department. Now, we don't know what the police commission is going to do January 4th, whether they're going to fire Louis K. Loha, whether they will permanently appoint Okimoto. But these are the kind of things that they will have to weigh if they really do want to put trust back into HPD.
And meanwhile, in terms of the sense of timing on that, as you mentioned, January 4th, the police commission, we know that later in January, the legislature comes back. Do you think that any of this may drift over in terms of the legislature's consideration for any of this?
You know, you wonder if something would be like that. Remember that the police departments are at the county level and that the police commission is an independent agency with the city and county. That said, lawmakers certainly have looked at police reform. They are in charge of the budgets, by the way, approving that for each of the counties. I haven't heard anybody yet say that it's found its way into potential legislation. But one also wonders with the city council. Remember, we also approved that charter amendment, Honolulu voters, this last election, to give the police commission more teeth, more bite, more authority to discipline HPD. So we wonder whether that will be taken to heart. It seems like the commission is stepping up, at least some of the members are stepping up their oversight. Before that, pretty much a lot of them just very much were in line with Louis K. Loha. Now more of them seem to be questioning what exactly is going on at HPD.
Excellent point to keep an eye on with the police commission. Thanks very much, Chad. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, joins us on the conversation on a regular basis.
Disney's newest film, Moana, pushes the boundaries of computer animation with respect to water. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday as we talk with the Disney animators about bringing animated water to life on screen and some fun facts from space.
You would be a melted, squished, acidy pile of goop on Venus.
More on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
And you're back with the conversation. This is the time on Fridays when our news director, Bill Dorman, joins us with a preview of what the news department's covering in the week to come. And since you're already here,
I'm already here. Might as well just talk about the news.
This is only the second time in 75 years that a Japanese prime minister has visited Hawaii, right?
Yeah, this is really going to be a remarkable, certainly, picture. Just the symbolism alone is, talking about Shinzo Abe coming to Pearl Harbor with President Obama. That visit's going to be on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And yesterday on the show, Brad Glosterman of Pacific CSIS had some good insights about that, spoke with Beth Ann in some detail on that. But there's also sort of a forward spin to look for on this. While President Obama is the host, President-elect Trump really is part of the audience on this.
Sure.
And whatever else you want to say about Shinzo Abe, he's a pretty wily politician. Remember, he was the first foreign leader to meet in person with Donald Trump after the election. Mm-hmm. He went to New York en route to the APEC meeting in Latin America and made a side stop.
Right.
So, again, there's that picture. There will be the front page dramatic picture with the two of them at the Arizona, I am imagining. But there's going to be a lot to look for in the details of how Abe sets this up for the future of U.S.-Japan relations.
Part of what we're going to be learning, Bill, is what Japan's priorities are in its Japan-U.S. relations, yeah?
It's true. And the regional, sort of the ears of the region looking at this and the eyes looking at how this goes, it's going to be an interesting time.
As always, when heads of state get together, there's a great deal of symbolism involved.
Exactly.
Everything
yeah,
they
sure.
do, right?
Absolutely.
This is also a time of the year in which we think about compassion or the lack of it in our society.
Yeah, and we've got a couple of things going on that. One, holiday season and helping others, a helping hands segment that Dave Lawrence does on All Things Considered this afternoon. The Big Brother, Big Sister program. The head of that organization, Dennis Brown, is the very first little brother. In Hawaii back to the early 1960s.
Uh-huh.
And also, we're going to be talking just in a bit to Kima Carvalho of IHS here. And speaking of homelessness, Molly Solomon did a piece today on the closing of Lighthouse Outreach Center in Waipahu. That's been a resource for homeless folks over there, including families. And that's sort of an overview. Next week, she's going to follow up with several families to see who are losing their places there, to see what they're doing and what as they go out into the community.
Out into who knows where, displaced during the season.
The height of the holiday season. It's a heartbreaking time.
It certainly is. Thanks a lot, Bill.
You bet. As we were just talking about, homelessness in Hawaii continues to be at a crisis level. One of the many challenges is documenting exactly how many homeless people are in our communities and where they are. That's a starting point for so much, not just in terms of the community itself and caring for them, but also for government policy and response. That's where the Point in Time Count comes in. The Institute for Human Services is a critical part of that effort each year. IHS is Hawaii's oldest, largest, and most comprehensive human services agency focused exclusively on homelessness in Hawaii. Next Point in Time Count comes early next year, and IHS could use some help with that. IHS Director of Community Relations Kimo Carvalho joins us to tell us more. And Kimo, thanks for coming in. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, and thanks for being here. You know, as a starting point, how do you use volunteers during the Point in Time Count?
So the Point in Time Count is very critical to obtaining federal funding that supports housing and homeless programs here in the state of Hawaii. And every year, we go out and ask the community to solicit volunteers and help to basically go out and count people on the last Monday of every January. So actually 1 month from now would be January 23rd, 2017. And we actually do several trainings. Trainings are very simple. It's actually understanding how to engage, approach a homeless client, what type of information we're obtaining, how that information is going to be used, and making it a safe and comfortable and positive experience for our volunteers.
You know, that's always something in terms of that initial approach, and having just been out with teams just as a reporter, as sort of more watching, it can be a tricky bit in terms of approaching homeless folks.
Absolutely. You don't want to scare them. You don't want to make them feel uncomfortable. You want to be compassionate but also clinical by nature. And we go through all those stages of understanding how to engage someone who's chronically homeless, somebody with a mental illness, what happens if they respond a certain way. So it's actually a really good opportunity just to experience what we do and how we engage clients and how we develop relationships with them in order to get to the root of their trauma and convince them and motivate them to come off the streets.
You know, because you see this every day and week in and week out, how are we doing overall in terms of homelessness, I guess, on the one hand, city and county of Honolulu, on the other hand, Hawaii more broadly, but how would you characterize? Is it getting better, worse, roughly the same? What do you think?
Sure. So, you know, if we look at the Point in Time Count as a baseline of measuring progress, you know, we did see an overall increase across the state of Hawaii last year. But actually for Honolulu, we saw some progress and some made some milestones. And so one of them is we saw a reduction in veterans homelessness. And that was really a good indicator because we as homeless providers were much more coordinated and actually went with a by name list, assigned those names to every homeless agency that was responsible for making sure that they access permanent housing quickly, and was much more coordinated and efficient. And so not only did we see a reduction in veterans homelessness, but we also saw, while it was a 1% increase in Honolulu's homeless point in time, it was still a reduction compared to the years prior. So I think that if we look at the point in time count as a measure of success, we are seeing somewhat progress. And I think that if we continue to look at the direction of, you know, better coordination, quick fast tracking into permanent housing, and designing shelter facilities that are more specialized and tailored to the individual clientele we're serving, I think we can see much more progress.
You know, I got to point out for those who haven't yet seen it, No Room in Paradise is a remarkable documentary about homelessness in Hawaii produced by Anthony Aalto and Mike Hinchy, aired on Hawaii News Now. It's also up on your website at ihshawaii.org. This project, one of the things that that program pointed out, and you just referred to it a little bit, was the idea of various populations, subsections of the homeless populations. And going ahead in terms of treatment and government policies dealing with that, that's such a critical part of this.
Absolutely. And I think that's also part of the progress that we should be making this next year. When we look at policies and our response to homeless populations, we have to look at every one of them differently. Chronic homeless or homeless with mental illnesses are very different from senior homelessness, from youth homelessness, from working homelessness. So we have to look at a triage system where we can actually look at what are their individual specialized needs. For our chronic mentally ill homeless clients, they are so costly to our system, and they are some of the hardest to serve because we have given them so much rights to refuse treatment. And it's not unless they're able to commit a crime. And that's how they access the state hospital.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, that's not fair. And so, you know, we have clients that have gotten psychiatric treatment and, you know, they realize, wow, 15 years of my life has gone by. Oh, my God, what has happened? And, you know, I think that we are being criminals to by nature by not giving them access to mental health treatment. And unless they commit a crime, that's kind of the case.
That's a heck of a way into the system. Kima, I got to mention your background. You were at Tulane, paramedic in New Orleans during Katrina. Anything that strikes you in terms of what you went through there and what when you look at the homeless situation here in Hawaii?
Yeah, so you know, I was a paramedic in New Orleans, and you know, when I saw, you know, this natural disaster in front of me, and I was one of those guys, by the way, that you saw, you know, on Black Hawk helicopters pulling people off roofs and, you know, on those boats pulling people into dry docks and waited for FEMA to show up 2 weeks later. And then all of a sudden you saw this robust response. And when I look at, you know, the natural disaster that happened to me or happened to us in at Tulane or in New Orleans, and I look at, you know, coming back home and I see homelessness as really a human disaster, I wonder why can't we respond the same way to my own home as we did in New Orleans to that type of natural disaster. We saw FEMA trailers pop up quickly. We had medical care, treatment programs, housing. I mean, it was so robust. And while it was temporary, it was still a step in the right direction. But we don't really see homelessness that to be that critical of a need.
The urgency.
The urgency is not there. And I think that's why, you know, I do what I do, and I try to, you know, really publicize and show our public through documentary film, through the news, what it is that we are experiencing, the realities of the clientele that we're serving.
Kima, thanks so much for coming in and sharing part of that story this morning. Kima Carvalho is the Director of Community Relations at the Institute for Human Services. The point in time homeless count for 2017 gets underway January 23rd. Training begins January 17th. You can find out more information at ihshawaii.org. Also, we'd like to hear from you about homelessness. If you have thoughts, if you have anything you would like to tell us on our talkback line, you can give us a call at 808-792-8217.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Hawaii Pacific University and Ulupono Initiative.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. I want you to visualize an elderly but robust great-grandmother. She's a barber with her own shop on Maui, and it's 80 years ago. When some relatives from Japan moved over here to work the fields, she purchased the store next door because there was room upstairs for her family to live, and both shops began to thrive. Tadami Kamitaki saw the success his mother was having in business and decided to start his own. So in 1951, he founded the first Ben Franklin store. It was on Maui, and it too thrived. So he opened another one in Hilo, and you guessed it, success. Now there are 28 Ben Franklin stores, and some of them are on the mainland. In 2011, four of the Kamitake cousins felt the time had come to give back to the community, so they started the House Mart Fund. So far, their donations have ranged from Big Brothers Big Sisters Maui to Hikino, the PBS student-generated news program. So you see, even a Tutu's Barbershop can be the source for truly benevolent minds. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio. It is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
For today's backyard quiz, we went aboard Smith's boats and plied the waters of the Wailua River on Kauai. The enterprise has been in business for about 60 years, and many thought it would never stay afloat. But now, people who have never even laid eyes on Kauai have dreamed of experiencing the Wailua River. One reason is it became associated with the melody that Elvis Presley recorded. Smith's entertainers still sing that song when their riverboats land at the Fern Grotto. By now, you probably guessed the song is Ke Kale Neau Are Waiting Here For You. Al Hoffman and Dick Manning translated it into English and renamed it the Hawaiian Wedding Song.
And, Chris, we had a winner on that. I don't know if it was the Elvis tip-off. Alice Tucker in Ainahaina called in, and she got that correct.
It's 8:48, and if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The Kwanzaa holiday is now 50 years old and has earned a permanent place in American culture. It came about when political activist and university professor Maulana Karenga, whose adopted surname means keeper of tradition in Swahili, saw the need for a celebration based on seven principles: unity, self-determination, collective responsibility, economic cooperation, purpose, creativity, and faith, principles derived from harvest season observances in Africa. We looked ahead to the holiday with Sandra Shawhan, vice president of the African Americans on Maui Association.
It's celebrated for 7 days with seven candles, and each candle has a principle, and it really is quite a celebration. And I know that some places on the mainland especially, it has been going on for at least 50 years.
This past year, 2016, has been a troubling one for the Black community, hasn't it?
I believe it has. It's been very troubling. Maybe not so in Hawaii. We seem to be a little bit more removed from it, although there is still racism here in the islands. I've been in Hawaii for 50 years and somewhat left the mainland in the late 60s because of all of the strife that was going on there and interracial differences, too. So I would say on the mainland, there's definitely been a lot of discord and a lot of tragic instances with people being shot and murdered and put in jail and families just being disrupted by all the violence. So I agree with you, yes.
Sandra, what's it going to take to reverse the troubling direction that we see in the newspapers?
Chris, you asked me a whole big, huge, political, economic question.
It's a pretty unfair question, isn't it?
A retired lady living in Hawaii. I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to sandbag you, Sandra, but, you know, it's just the direction I think a lot of people are thinking about, don't you?
I know they are. Black Lives Matter, you know, that's very prominent on the news and in our hearts also. And there are many, many people working to help solve this problem, but it hasn't reached a final solution yet. And it's going to take a lot of minds, a lot of helping hands, a lot of people thinking in the right direction, a lot of people working together, especially. And the principle of Kwanzaa, it's called Umoja, and that's unity. It's the first candle that we light on December 26th.
Well, Sandra, well, one of the reasons I asked that terribly unfair question was that I think that in the Kwanzaa celebration, there's maybe the seeds to an answer, don't you think?
Well, if we really practice the seven principles of Kwanzaa, they all have within each principle something that would be healing to the community. It's Kwanzaa is, its focus is to celebrate the many different customs of Africa and the many different traditions that we have here in America. We have self-determination that we decide for ourselves what's best for ourselves and our community. And we have cooperative economics, and we have all of these things within the seven principles of Kwanzaa that would help lead to some kind of solution or help bring people together and unite this massive movement. It's just that people have their own ways and they have their own thoughts and about how things should be done. So we're not unified yet.
Maybe you've hit on something there, Sandra. People have their own ways, and you know, sometimes I think that even people who have similar goals tend to isolate themselves in separate compartments. Have you seen a little bit of that?
Somewhat. I'm not really that involved politically with here in Hawaii. I do belong to a group on Maui called the African Americans on Maui. Mm-hmm. And we'll be celebrating Kwanzaa next week, Monday. And I know there was a Kwanzaa celebration here on Oahu at the Halekoa Beach Park on December the 10th. I wasn't able to attend that, so I can't really speak to what kind of event that was. But it was a recognition of Kwanzaa, and it was a celebration of the seven principles and seven traditions of Kwanzaa. So there was some recognition anyway. I don't know to what extent it will, you know, relegate itself onto an answer for what goes on in this community, but at least it was in some kind of recognition, yes.
Well, just to be clear, Sandra, the seven principles and the celebration of Kwanzaa in general, there's no reason for that to be isolated to African Americans, right?
Oh, absolutely not. It's a community event. It should be a community event. Actually, it begins in the family. You know, different families set up their Kwanzaa gear, to say, the kinara, the candles, the vegetables, because Kwanzaa means first fruit. So they have vegetables and the ears of corn represent the number of children in the family, and they have the unity cup, and all of this is set up. And each night of Kwanzaa, a candle is lit. Red means the struggle that the African Americans have gone through. Black represents the African American people and unity, and green is the hope, and that may be where the future of Kwanzaa really lies, because there's always hope. There's always been struggle, and we know the different kinds of struggle that there's been in our lives and in our country and in our world. But there's also hope. So that may be where some of the solutions come to help to unify the goals and the necessities of trying to make this world a better place.
Sandra Shawhan is the vice president of the African Americans on Maui Association. Kwanzaa, now in its 50th year, is celebrated from Monday, December 26th, to New Year's Day. The association is holding a Kwanzaa observance on Thursday, December 29th, from 6 to 8:30 at the Iao Parkside Recreational Center.
Chris, you know, Sharon talking about different kinds of struggle and hope. Like,
yeah.
I can't help but think about homelessness.
I had the same thought when she said that, Bill, because I've been in Hawaii long enough to remember when the Institute for Human Services, IHS, was the only game in town for the homeless. It was very much the product of Reverend Claude Dutille's initiative, and he really gave his life to that cause. The numbers were a fraction of what they are now. I'm not sure it was possible, say, 30 years ago, to foresee the expansion of the problem the way to where it is today.
It's really, again, everybody talking in terms of holiday season, and that's all true. But again, Sharon talking about a lot of people working together, again, that sort of brings me back to addressing homelessness, which has not gone away in any sense, and remains such a problem on so many levels.
There's so many problems associated with it, and there's so much of an effort of will on the part of the whole community required. It doesn't seem to have manifested yet.
But we know there's a lot of aloha out there as well. That's it for this week. Next week on Tuesday, Hawaii's Educational Policy Center Director Jim Sean reviews the governor's goal of transforming education through a more campus-based orientation.
On Monday, our program will look back at some of the most intriguing conversations of the past year.
Love to hear from you. You can call our talkback line, leave your comments at 808-792-8217. Email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or Beth Ann at BKOZHPR.
If you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find a playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, which is also where you can listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And we hope she's feeling better. Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiano are our production assistants.
And all of us thank you, Bill Dorman, for filling in for Beth Ann these last 3 days.
It's a lot of fun.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello, and I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bill Dorman. Join us Monday. Pick up the conversation.